Dr. Michael Osterholm is our next speaker. He is a professor of public health at the University of Minnesota, and he's also a director of the Center for Infectious Disease and Research and Policy. Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, and just listening to this conversation, it's obviously very wide and broad. Let me try to put some context to it about where I think we're going over the upcoming months. Those of us who have been working in the area of pandemics have been preparing for this for some time, knowing that this event would happen. But like many, we're at that point now of knowing how will it end, and I think that's unclear. I would suggest that Sir Winston Churchill's quote that we're not at the end, we're not even at the beginning of the end, but rather we're at the end of the beginning, is probably a fair way to look at this whole situation. We've already heard about transmission issues, asymptomatic infections, but I think we can all can agree that at the very best, we can say that no more than 5 to 7% of most of the population in this country has been infected with this virus, even in some of the hotspots. And for many parts of the country, it's much less than that. As someone who has worked in infectious diseases and respiratory transmitted diseases for some time, it's very clear that this virus is going to continue to spread until likely it gets well into the 60 to 70% total population infection range, meaning that in order to really induce herd immunity, it's going to probably take that much because of just the infectivity of this virus. That means we have a long ways to go yet. And I think that what I worry about right now is that we are a nation that's waiting to get back to normalcy, which, of course, we never will. We will have a new normal. But the bottom line is, because of that, I think we're talking about and considering policies that really aren't in our best interest in terms of understanding what the future might bring. Right now, one can look at models, and surely models have been the word of the pandemic so far. And I like to look at it this way. We can have, whether it's the University of Washington model or the Imperial College models or any other that have been out there that have given these wide ranges, we all have to understand that at the best, they are black box analyses where conditions are put into play that can surely vary a great deal, as those two model sets have. I likened it to my rural Iowa upbringing, where the guy that's sitting in the restaurant and common sense, what plays with him. And I think to give you a sense of where I see this going, and I think a number of my colleagues, is that regardless of what your estimates are, just take 320 million Americans, and if you assume 50% will ultimately be infected over the months ahead, however that happens, which I think is a very fair estimate. If you look at, and you surely can consider the larger number of asymptomatic infections, but even just take it among those who are clinically ill and the numbers we see, you can estimate that 80% or more, based on what we've seen in Asia, what we've seen in Europe, what we've seen in the Americas, will be mild, moderate to asymptomatic infections. 20% will seek some form of medical care overall, and of those, likely 10% could be hospitalized, 5% will need intensive care medicine, and about 1% to 0.5% will die. If you look at the fact that we now are slightly over 23,000 deaths in the United States, that 0.5 to 1% of 160 million is 800,000 to 1.6 million people. That means that if you believe it, that's a possible model that we'll have to hold as this virus unfolds over the months ahead. We have a long, long ways to go yet. Now, clearly, all the interventions we want to bring, vaccines, et cetera, will play. Right now, I see us really in two lanes of decision-making. One is a shutdown, much like was done in Wuhan, where it really did take that incredibly draconian measures of population movement limitation to bring about what happened there. And as we're seeing now, as those individuals are coming back into the workforce, new transmission issues in China, we've seen that in other countries of Asia that were for so long considered to be the models of how to completely suppress the infection. And I think all of us would agree, if we're holding out for a vaccine one day, which may or may not occur, and we don't know the timeline, as we've talked about, when that will occur, this is probably not a logical or an acceptable model to go with. This is total shutdown. It will destroy the economy. Society will be changed forever. And we aren't sure necessarily what we'll accomplish. At the other hand, we have the situation where we just basically say, let it go. And we all know that the implications there on our healthcare systems, as we've seen in New York, Italy, other cities in North America, Europe, Asia, have dramatic implications for what that means. And I think we'd all agree that it's not just the fact that it's been discussed here, that it's just COVID-19 patients we have to be concerned about. But when you bring healthcare systems basically to the level that we've seen in these major spillover events, the care is also highly compromised for everyone else in the community. So that's not it. So I think that what we're all trying to find is how to thread the rope through the needle in the middle. How do we bring us back in some way that allows those who potentially are at lower risk of having serious disease or dying, who are younger in many cases, that can be part of active society, moving the economy forward, holding down jobs, et cetera, and at the same time trying to protect as best we can those who may be at highest risk with the hope of staving off their infection until sometime when we have a vaccine. I think this is the issue that we really have to deal with. Our challenges are we don't have many tools. We have a tool of suppression, movement of populations. We have a tool right now basically of looking at testing and trying to do contact tracing, which if you'll follow, I think the media this week, you're going to see the many challenges to that, including a major shortage of reagents worldwide as suddenly everyone in the world wants to test. Some of the challenges about the overall predictive value of positives in Minnesota right now, or if you were to test for antibody, even using the best test we have, you'd have as many false positive antibody positive individuals as you would have actual true infected or true antibody positives. And so there's just a lot of challenges there. So I think as we go forward, one of the things we have to do is realize that we are going to be facing a lot of additional difficult days ahead. How that will play out, as given that this is not an influenza model, which John Barry can surely tell us a lot about and has, but this is a coronavirus. For many of us, there are enough similarities between the coronavirus and influenza to suggest that we can learn a lot from previous influenza pandemics in terms of what will happen. But I think the message here is that all these topics we're talking about today are incredibly important because we are just really in the first or second inning of this nine-inning game. And over the next 16 to 18 months or more, we're going to be faced with many of these challenges. And this is not just a theoretical risk. We're flattening the curve, but this is just the first of potentially many curves to come.
Michael, thank you. I'm going to come back to you with questions and answers in the question and answer period.